Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming out this evening. We're going to go ahead and get started. We will be on framework. We'll be on page 274. I'd like to make it to page 281 tonight, covering the years 350 AD to 450 AD. Beginning on page 274 and 275, I want to just read through a list of some of the church fathers of this time period. It's a time period after the Nicene Council, or right around that time leading up to it and following it. Then on the board here, I'm going to read through some of this information in the book. These are some emperors after Constantine, his son, and then those that followed after, including, remember, his son, Constantius, was the one that ended up executing all of the relatives, along with his two other brothers. All of the relatives were executed so that they would have the only claim to the throne. One of the brothers is killed by another brother. Another brother dies in battle against the barbarians. And Constantius is the last of Constantine's sons alive, which is the only living member of his family, except for a young child that was not executed named Julian, who is forced into Christianity and grows up in Christian schools and being trained and all of Christendom of that time, which was a very oppressive religion at that time. And when he becomes king, he goes into that king, becomes emperor. When he takes the throne, he ends up becoming a very, very strong pagan and worships the Greek gods and advances paganism. That's why he's known as Julian the Apostate. So Constantine's Christianity, as far as being handed down through the generations, didn't even make it. Well, Constantius was a Christian, but he was not what we'd consider Christian. He was by name only and used Christianity as a club to oppress. Not a club like a membership club, but a weapon club. And then Julian the Apostate would be the third generation, if you want to call it the third generation, of anyone related to Constantine. He's an apostate. So Constantine's family did not maintain Christianity very long at all. And then anyway, these are the other emperors we'll address. So first of all, we're going to look at I just want to read through, just to mention their names, give you a little bit of background. You've got the information right in front of you. Some of these guys we've mentioned already, but some of them I want to make sure at least their name pops up on the radar so you know that they're, again, because you've got, we end up talking mostly about Western Christianity, which is Latin Christianity, Roman Catholicism, which becomes Protestantism, but we're leave behind so many names in the Greek church, the Greek Orthodox church. Which was overrun early by Muslims, with the churches in Turkey, in Syria, in the East, the Greek Orthodox Church. We've got Greek Orthodox churches that have followed into the Western world, but their basis is still in where the Greek language was prominent. Here we go. Eusebius, you can see the years there. 263 is when he's born, died in 339 from Caesarea. That would be right there on the coast of Israel. He was a church historian, and we thank him because he did a lot of writing. We've mentioned that before on the history of the church, going back to the days of the apostles, writing all the way up into his time, particularly covering Constantine, who was a good friend of his, and he knew and wrote the life of Constantine. He taught in a theological school during his life at Caesarea or in Israel, a friend of Constantine, and recorded Constantine's life in all of his works. Athanasius. He defended Trinitarian doctrine. You remember him as being the one who came against Arianism. He's the one who had a correct understanding of who Jesus Christ was, the eternal God who took on flesh, became man. And so again, he championed the cause against Arius or Arianism. He was an important speaker at the Council of Nicaea. In fact, he wrote some of the terminology that was used in the Nicene Creed. Because of what follows, of course, Athanasius won the day at the Council of Nicaea, and Athanasius' creed, the deity of Jesus Christ, which we understand today, that's how we would believe it, won the day. And so the Arians were dismissed. They were considered heretics. They were sometimes exiled. Well, they're going to regain power after Constantine through Constantius, and that's where Athanasius, as you see the last point there, he is going to be exiled five times in his lifetime. And he's going to be sent off and abandoned, not executed, but just left. You can't join the church. You can't join the society. You're exiled on an island or you're exiled somewhere, just living your life out away from people. Somehow he'd make it back. Someone would release him from exile, kind of like John was put on the Isle of Patmos and then was released after the government powers changed. Athanasius came and left five different times. Another Basil, one we don't know much about, is 330 to 379. He was raised as a Christian. He's one of the heroes of the Greek Orthodox Church. In fact, his writings are very, very important. He was raised as a Christian. He studied philosophy in Athens, lived as an ascetic. In 358, he established a monastic community to replace individual monks. He was one of those that organized. We mentioned him last week. Instead of just having the monks go off and live by themselves, he organized the monastic life or the community. He became the bishop of Caesarea at Cappadocia, and he opposed Arius and Arianism, established a hospital for lepers along with a school, a hospice, and other social programs. So not only were they, you know, he's building more on the idea of instead of going away and being a monk and living off alone and searching for God, is you dedicate your life to God, join up with others, and then you begin to do good works for your community. And that's more of the monastic image that he was building. Gregory of Nyssus, again, Cappadocia, which is Asia Minor, or Turkey. He was, again, a great theologian of the Greek Orthodox Church, instrumental in the doctrine of the Trinity. And again, we're in the year, 350, 390, and the doctrine of the Trinity is still, they're still grabbing at it, trying to nail it down. Again, great development began with Tertullian, with the Latin, but here again, they're still ironing things out, and Gregory of Nyssa was instrumental in establishing correct doctrine of the Trinity. Again, that's the Greek Orthodox Church, hero of them. He was a leader of the Council of Constantinople in 381. Now, we've mentioned the Council of Nicaea. We're heading towards the Council of Constantinople. Remember, Rome is going to move, the headquarters of Rome, of the Roman Empire, is going to move to Byzantine or Constantinople. And there's going to be a council held there, which is very close to Nicaea, but it's going to be over there in the eastern portion of the Greek Empire. And there's going to be some things we'll talk about that are ironed out there at the Council of Constantinople. Ambrose, we've mentioned him a couple times, but he is going to be prominent. Lived from 340 to 397 in Milan, living north of Rome in Italy. He was the father of the, his father was a Praetorian Perfect in Gaul. Again, the Praetorian Guard, they're the ones who guarded the emperor. They were his personal bodyguard. So to be a father, a Praetorian, would be one of the leaders of the Praetorian Guard, and who was then sent to Gaul to be a leader, a perfect, or a governor in Gaul. That was his father. He studied in Rome and became a consul in Milan, meaning that's a Roman position in the government, a consul. But he was so successful, we'll read about him later, he was so successful as a governmental leader that the Christians, when the bishop time came to find a bishop, they voted him in to be their bishop of Milan. And before he even was baptized, he was, in a sense, forced into that position of being the leader of the church or the bishop of that area because of his great organizational administrative skills. Now, it wasn't that he was anti-Christian. It was just that he was more, living in culture. But he was such a great guy, not a friendly guy per se, although I'm not saying he wasn't friendly. But his leadership, the church saw that they wanted his skills in the church. And we'll read about that later on. And so he was elected bishop of Milan in 373 by the people before he had been baptized. He was a powerful preacher who influenced the Roman emperors. And so with that kind of a background, that kind of influence, Ambrose is going to be one of these guys who's going to call some of these gentlemen to account. He's a bishop. He's going to hold over them the authority of Jesus, the authority of the church, the authority of God, the authority of the position that he has over them, and hold things back from them if they don't do what he thinks is correct. Again, you're going to have that crossing of church and state. We all want Christian leaders, but here's one of those confusing situations where the bishop is going to actually be making political decisions on what he thinks is right, and then, in a sense, forcing the leadership or the government leaders to do what they want, threatening things like excommunication or not giving them communion or whatever it is. And they're more fearful of the spiritual power behind the throne than they are of doing what they think is the right thing. Again, it's good and it's bad. Sometimes it's a good thing, but sometimes it can be used in a corrupt way. And once again, we talk about separation of powers in our own government, but we maybe say, well, we want the church involved in the state. I think when you look at history, there's a huge discussion. I don't know if we want church and state united. We once again would like to have the separation of powers where you've got governmental leaders taking care of the temporal things. You've got the spiritual leaders taking care of the kingdom of God, representing the church. It'd be nice if their influence was on the hearts of these leaders. Jesus answered it the simplest, I think. You know, give me a coin. Whose image is on the coin? Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Give to God what is God's. That doesn't mean you can't have Christian leadership, but it does mean it's nice not to have the church leaders meddling in governmental affairs, viewing it only from their Christian churchy vision or their churchy vision or position. Anyway, that's all. We're going to keep cycling through this, that issue, from the days of before Constantine, in Constantine, into these issues here tonight, all the way up into the Reformation, well, all the way through the Catholic Church, into the Reformation, into the founding of our country when you've got the Puritans coming over, and then you've got the liberals like Thomas Jefferson, you know, believing in God, but, you know, founding on historical principles, a nation on some things that they believed in God, didn't deny God, but it's like, okay, but we are here to manage today. God is taking care of His kingdom. We need to take care of what God has instituted to us. Again, it's a huge discussion, but you can see this is not going away. And it's interesting to see people sometimes rise up and, I'll throw this out there, we need prayer back in schools. We need prayer back in schools. It's like, what a great thing. That's a great argument. But it's like, no, you don't. You don't want prayer back in school. You need prayer in your churches. You need prayer in your home. You need prayer in your life. Schools are not places of prayer. They're places of education. And it's like, and if you unleash prayer back into schools today, who are you praying to and what kind of prayers are you offering? Because it's not like it was. When your whole culture is Christian, prayer in school is one thing. But we're such a divided culture that if prayer were to come back in school, oh my goodness, you know, who would be leading the prayer? I mean, you know, okay, that's enough of that. Okay. I mean, just things to think about. You can have your idea. What I'm saying is you have this ideal world where everyone's a Christian. Everybody's having, you know, Bible study and prayer before class. But I've been in some churches I didn't like how they are praying. And they're Christians and they're praying and teaching. That's not, I didn't think it was correct. So let alone the public school. Okay. Next, John Chrysostom. Again, someone from the Greek side, a Greek Orthodox side, in Antioch. Again, Antioch in Constantinople. Antioch is in Syria where Paul was from. Peter preached there. He was born in Antioch, a priest in Antioch, and a bishop of Constantinople. Notice the word priest pops up. He was ordained as a priest. He's now, the church has got priests taking place here by 350. Because Constantine has come in, established Christianity as a national religion, and they took over the pagan practices, the pagan buildings, which had priesthoods. They justify it because the Old Testament had a priesthood, but it's really kind of hard to find who's a priest and who's not a priest in the New Testament church. Where's the office of priest? Where's the gift of priest? And I mean, if you get into it, Jesus is the high priest and we are all priests under him. But nonetheless, here's the term priest coming in. You can start seeing pagan influence and reaching into the Old Testament, try and adjust your pagan practice of a priesthood. But nonetheless, John Chrysostom was called a priest in Antioch. He's a bishop of Constantinople. He was called Chrysostomus, which basically means golden mouth. So his name was not John Chrysostom. That wasn't his last name. His name was John the Golden Mouth, which means he was an excellent, excellent speaker because of his elegant preaching ability. No one's ever called me Golden Mouth because I can hardly pronounce the words I'm trying to say. So that's one thing they maybe call, you know, rapid fire jabbermouth, but not elegant, you know. He followed the natural meanings of the scripture, which is nice, meaning his style of teaching was scriptural exegetical instead of allegorical. So that was a break from some of the things that had been going on. He preached right through the books of the Bible, which is very interesting. I mean, his teaching was he was marched through Thessalonians as he was teaching the text of Scripture. He was exiled for criticizing the church and calling for reform. He ends up getting exiled by the church because he says we're going the wrong way. And you can see right there, maybe he's coming against their style of teaching, their style of leadership, their goals, the way the church is functioning. And notice in the years 350 to 407, you can kind of picture what's going on in the church in those years, including coming out of the days of Constantius, Julian the Apostate, and on into these areas, including Ambrose dabbling into these affairs and threatening these men with excommunication, things that they don't do what he wants them to do, where you got the bishop trying to, or the popes, you know, or arising popes, telling the emperors what they want to have done. And so these would be some of the things that he would criticize, say that's none of your business, or the way he was teaching. And he ends up being exiled because he wanted to reform because the church he saw drifting off. Jerome. You want to make sure you recognize Jerome. He was from Rome. He's from Antioch. He's from Bethlehem. He's going to end up in Bethlehem. In fact, if you've been to Bethlehem to the Church of the Nativity, which I think is a very legitimate site for the place of the birth of Christ because it goes back to the earliest days. If it was a cave that was built around, you know, the cave would have been used as a manger or a barn, storing animals, whatever. It seems very legitimate once you get into it, the Church of the Nativity. It doesn't look anything like you'd want it to look like, once again. But it is an ancient church. I'm off subject here. But he ends up in Bethlehem in a monastery in what is today the Church of the Nativity. And it's one of the earliest churches that wasn't destroyed because when the Persians, before Islam came, the Persians came through and destroyed Christianity, destroyed all the ancient churches that we wish still stood. But they were all just demolished. But when they came to the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, on the wall were images of the three wise men, and they were dressed as Persians because they came from the east. They had the Persian style. They looked like Persians, and they were painted on the wall. And so the Persians did not destroy the Church of the Nativity. It still goes way back to some of the earliest days. And then Constantine comes, and we'll talk about that later on here tonight, hopefully. But anyway, Jerome studied in Rome. He lived as a hermit for 3 years, was at the Council of Constantinople. They took a role on who was there in 381. He served as a secretary to the Roman bishop Damascus. Now, that means Damascus, the bishop of Rome, is the pope. I mean, if we'd call him who he is today, he's the head of the church. They still were calling him the bishop, but he was the chief bishop. He was the first bishop. Eventually, the next second bishop is going to be the bishop of Constantinople as far as ranking, and eventually the first bishop of Rome, is going to be called the pope. So Jerome was his secretary. He was the one who handled all, you know, if you had a, you know, what's the lady that if you got to see Hillary, you had to go through that one, Huma, what's her name? You know, he was that type. He was the guy that took care of all the meetings, took care of everything for the Bishop of Rome, and was in running to be the next Rome. When they voted for the next bishop, next Bishop of Rome, Jerome was aiming for that position. He ends up being beaten. There's a lot of animosity because of his personality and his just the style of person he was. He was, I use the word aggressive because I can't think of something better, but he said what he meant and got things done. And when he didn't get things done the way he wanted to, he just packed up and ends up going to a monastery, starting a school and researching in Bethlehem. And he established a monastery there. And he came into conflict with Origen's teaching. Origen, again, was very allegorical, coming out of Africa. Jerome was very well studied, knew the language, knew the translations, was a great teacher, had Bible studies through the Word of God. And the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, is eventually going, and we'll talk about this later, is eventually going to ask Jerome in Bethlehem if he would take time to give them an improved Latin translation. We've said this a couple times already. And Jerome then takes and translates the Greek and the Hebrew into what is called the Latin Vulgate, the accepted Latin translation. And of course, because by that time, there had been so many different translations and rewrites and corrections that it had become scattered. It had become, there's been arguments on verses, no one really knew what the verses meant in many cases. Jerome went back to the original languages and produced the Latin Vulgate, which cleaned it up and pushed it from the Greek into another translation, another generation of writing. And he knew Hebrew, so he could translate the Hebrew into Latin. So it was a champion's Bible. And again, even the Catholic Church today, that is the Bible they still use. They still use Jerome's translation. Of course, they've got to translate it from Latin into English, but that's still a pretty, you know, good translation if you go from Greek to Latin into English. Again, it's best to go from Greek into English every time. But nonetheless, Jerome had that kind of skill. And so Jerome, don't forget Jerome, after having lost the bishop position in Rome, he ends up doing what the bishop wanted him to do as far as writing the translation. Theodore was born in Antioch, influential representative of the thinking and interpretation of Scripture practiced in Antioch. He was a leader of exegetical Bible learning, which is always encouraging to hear. He was an ascetic. His doctrine of incarnation was condemned at the Council of Ephesus in 431, another one of the church councils, because he was judged as a heretic in 553 at the Council of Constantinople. That would be the second one, because it was too close to Nestorius. He contributed to Christology, the human soul of Christ, and Christ's free moral activity in the work of redemption. In other words, there were some things that he was working through, and again, he ends up being a heretic because it didn't line up right with what comes out at the end, but yet he was a very good biblical person. Again, he's from Antioch. He'd be someone that you'd find over in the Greek Orthodox Church. Augustine, next to Paul, and this is a true statement that no one probably is going to argue with this, the statement, next to Paul, Augustine was the most influential man in church history because of what he did. His views of the church and the sacraments developed into the Roman Catholic doctrine. Now, Augustine was very influential. He identifies sin. He identifies original sin. He identifies a wide variety of things that we just accept today as truth, as doctrinal statements. He's the one who wrapped his mind around them. But yet there's some things he did that were just, it's like, how can a great person, I mean, he believed in infant baptism. He promoted other things that, for example, myself, I'd be like, that's not the way it works. But yet Augustine had great influence. I write this right here. His view of the church, again, that unity of the church, that there's one church, salvation has to come from the one church. If you leave the church, you can't find salvation outside the church. Now, again, in a universal sense, salvation comes through Jesus Christ, who's building his church. Okay, I'm all right with that. But you can't say this church organization on this corner and all the churches affiliated with it is the only church. All these others here are not the correct church. And yet he's building the concept of the universal church, which is the Catholic Church. And it lays the foundation for what's coming in the Middle Ages. Also, the sacraments, meaning what happens with the sacraments. We'll talk about that at other times too, but again, is there power in the sacraments? Is there actual transformation in the sacraments, the juice and the bread or the crackers and the wine, whatever you use? Or are they symbols representing, causing you to remember? Or is there actual power in them? And as this thing bleeds on down through into here, the leaders are going to push the concept that there's power in these elements. And if you don't do what we want, we keep them and you're without salvation because you've got to have this to have salvation. It's becoming mystical, magical. It's becoming some kind of a pagan religion. And Augustine somehow adds to that concept in his thinking. Again, people are people of their age. You know, I mean, I'm a person of my age right now. Some of the things I say, everyone today, or what things you say, people just accept because that's who we are. But you go 100 years from now or you go 200 years back, the things we say and accept now, I mean, assuming that we're saying what we think is correct, people just shake their heads. What were they thinking? Why did Galen teach that? That's so weird. And yet, you know, I don't think I teach anything weird. Well, sometimes I do. But some of the things, these people are people of their culture. They're people of their age, and this is the way they thought. And they were influenced from, I mean, they're close to Constantine. They're close to persecution. There's a lot of things taking place here. Okay. Augustine's ideas are still studied, faith and reason, even outside of the Christian realm. His understanding of faith and reason, what comes first, faith or reason? Does reason affect faith or does faith affect reason? These things are still studied even in philosophy of his writings. He also taught predestination, the Trinity, and he answered the question of the problem of evil. Next, Cyril from Alexandria, a patriarch of Alexandria in 412, vigorously opposed pagans, Novotanists, Judaizers. Again, this is strange right here when it says opposed pagans. I oppose pagans. I mean, I don't agree with them. But this opposed pagans that they're referring to here, is he persecuted them, killed them, got rid of them, burnt their buildings. They didn't deserve. I mean, he's like bringing the kingdom of God in vengeance and having the church do it. He was involved in Hypatia's murder, a famous pagan philosopher. We'll talk about that because they did not agree with Christianity. He had them killed. His emphasis on Christ's divine nature evolved into a monophysite view that Christ only had one nature. Again, that whole concept of is he just one nature or is there two? He's eternal God, but he's also fully man. We're comfortable with that. He's fully eternal God and he's fully man. He's got two natures in one person. It's like he's the unique hypostatic union. It's like there's nobody like him. And again, how do you explain that? Was that orthodox in what I just said? Some people say, well, he's got to be just one. He's got to be one person. He was always God. Well, then he's just acting like a man. Yeah, he's just pretending to be a man. It's like, well, then he's not really a man. So he didn't really die on the cross. He didn't really have flesh. So he's got to be fully man to fully die for our sins. And so this argument just goes on and on and on. There is an answer to it, but most often it's beyond our human understanding. We can talk about it, get closer to it, pass by it, come back, talk about it some more, get close to it, almost like orbiting, you know, the sun. You're closer, sometimes you're further away, if that makes sense. Patrick, born in Britain, this is the man, St. Patrick. Notice his years, 389 to 461. When I first started getting the church history, say 20, 25 years ago, this was one of the things that just, I knew who St. Patrick was, you know, green, clovers, you know, Ireland. But to realize he was a historical person, not some kind of leprechaun with, you know, some church connection, that he was a real man. And so many, he wrote things down. There's letters we've gotten that were written by Patrick. And so you can do some good historical research on Patrick. And his years were 389 to 461. He was born in Britain after Rome had abandoned it. Because of the barbarian invasion, Rome had to give up this northern frontier and move down, you know, back towards their home. And so Britain was abandoned, leaving it kind of to chaos. Who's going to come in? Who's going to be the tribal leaders of Britain? He was taken captive by pirates as a boy and sold into Ireland as a slave. He finally escaped back to Britain and entered the ministry. After a vision, he returned to evangelize Ireland in 432. And all that, there's many things can be said about that which are interesting. And all you got to do is Google it. You can read about Patrick, and I'll cover some more here later on. Leo the Great. This is another great character in church history. Something that you would be like, you've got to make some decisions on. Well, is he really a great Christian leader? Or is he a man, you know, stepping out of his position? Or is he just, well, here's something about Leo the Great. 390 to 461. Now realize, he is going to be a church leader, but he's going to be in Rome. Well, he's a Roman bishop in 440 and became the first pope. He is going to be the first pope. Because by 440, the Roman government has collapsed in Rome. It's in Constantinople. It's been overrun by barbarians. And the only people that stayed were the church. That's their territory. The church held their own. So congratulations, Leo. Thanks for staying here. And because you're the bishop of Rome, I'm staying. Everybody else is leaving as far as government responsibilities. So he's the first pope. His Christology, with the nation of Christ, was a teaching that adopted by the church at the Council of Chalcedon in 451. So he influenced the nature of Christ, what they accepted. He negotiated with Attila the Hun for the removal of barbarians from Italy in 452. So why is the Pope or the Bishop of Rome, the leader of the church, negotiating with the invaders? Because the government has collapsed. They've moved on. So the church is left. And so this is that catch 22. It's like, well, this is not your responsibility. We believe in separation of church and state. There is no state. The only thing left here of organization is the church. I'm the last man standing, the bishop would say. So if I'm going to save my people, my congregants, my church, I've got to go off and negotiate with the invaders. And I'm going to have a military. I'm going to have some weapons. I'm going to have some defense. And all of a sudden, he finds himself replacing the government while he's the head of the church. And thus begins a very confusing time of church history, which we would say, that's not right. But once you see it develop, it's kind of like, oh. Well, what would you have done? Just let Attila the Hun come in and, well, we're Christian, let him get slaughtered? Or would you stepped up and say, we need military, we need a government, we need something? Well, he negotiated with Attila the Hun, which is kind of an interesting fact. He taught that the Bishop of Rome held the same position as Peter, which established the basis for the Pope or the papacy. Again, I would disagree with that completely, but he's looking for some political traction at that time to say, I'm in charge, and I've got Peter's position, and so spin that as you can on the news and get me in charge so I can save Italy. Again, don't agree with it, but what would you do if you're at that time and there's no government, you're the one last man standing? Benedict, you heard of Saint Benedict, born in Italy, Norcia, to a wealthy and influential family. He studied in Rome. He lived as a hermit in caves, but joined with other hermits. He saw the need to organize the monastic structure. And again, we've seen that in the East with guys like Basil and others. Now we're over in Latin or in Italy, where now they're doing the same thing. We need to organize these monks, so not all just living in a cave, fending for themselves. His efforts became known as the Rule of Saint Benedict, meaning they had the list of rules. These are the 10 rules of how we live our lives. Benedict developed pattern for the Byzantine monasticism. And so when you see monasteries in the Western world, they're following Benedict's guide. If you go over to the East, you're going to have guys like Gregory or someone as far as establishing their principles. Now, if we go to page, I just want to run through those names. There's a lot of names there covering several years. Some of them we're going to now be bumping into as we go through here. Again, we talked on this last week. This is after Constantine dies, and Constantinople was established as the capital of the Roman Empire in May 11th, 330. Emperor Constantius, that would be one of Constantine's sons. You see the three of them mentioned there, Constantine II, Constans, and Constantius. They killed hundreds of their father's offspring, except two guys, Gallus, or Gallus and Julian, who were sick and a youth. So Gallus was too sick to kill. I mean, he's not a threat. He can't even move. And Julian was a child. Well, that would have been a, you know, if you're going to kill people, it would have been good to get rid of him. They didn't kill him. Constans then slew Constantine II, his brother, and then he himself was killed fighting the barbarians. Remember, this whole time, Rome is not the glorious Rome that you think about at this time. That's why they're moving to Constantinople. They move because of pressure from the north. The barbarians are coming in. So they're fighting the barbarians, and one of these brothers is killed fighting the barbarians, and the empire has moved to the east, which is very interesting. Western Rome has, in a sense, fallen to the barbarians, and the only thing left is Christianity. And Christianity is going to rise up out of the ashes and take Europe, which is, again, very interesting. It wasn't taken by a military force. It was taken because Christianity had some value. It had some substance, some kind of truth to it, that it could influence the people that were conquering it. They were influenced by it. People invaded, and Christianity took over. Meanwhile, the church moved east, and they're going to meet the Muslims in a few centuries. Constantius became the sole emperor in 353. Constantius began a violent suppression of the heathen religion. I mentioned this last week. Pillaged and destroyed the temples of the pagans, gave the booty to the church, and prohibited all sacrifice and worship of images in Rome, Alexandria, and Athens. Obviously, many people became Christians, I write, because who wants to get killed? Yeah, I'm a Christian. So he's converting Christians like the Muslims convert Muslims today. I'll cut your head off if you don't agree. And that's when Athanasius, remember we talked about Athanasius, one of the Nicene Council. I read that quote to you last week where Satan, because there's no truth, he has to conquer by sword, where Christ can come in and be reasonable and bring you truth and persuade you to follow. And you can read that quote. And that he's speaking about these days right here. So Christianity, in a matter of 40 years, I ended last week saying this, has done a full circle from going from being persecuted and arguing their case, having great apologists, writing books, trying to persuade people. Look at this again. To winning the day, becoming the powerful religion of the Roman Empire, and now persecuting those who won't agree. No longer need to persuade you. We'll just crush you if you don't agree. Do you agree with us? And here again is the value. This is the value of persecution or oppression, is you've got to present the truth. You've got to be reasonable. You've got to bring logic. And that's the nature of God. That's the nature of Jesus Christ, to win the hearts of people. If you have the power and all you've got to do is demand obedience, That's not faith. That's not even Christianity. That's you taking power. And Jesus makes it very clear to his disciples. He says, you're not going to be like the world. You're not going to lord it over people. You're going to serve them. And serving doesn't just mean, you know, going off and doing good deeds. It means serving also them the truth. Feed my sheep. Reason with the people. Present the truth. Well, once you got the power, you don't just conquer them. You still got to present the truth. That's a huge, huge point, I think. If anything else we learn, that is an important point. Now, the result of Constantius is the Emperor Julian the Apostate. The years he lived, 331 to 363, he was a cousin of Constantius and a nephew of Constantine. So you see, he's, you know, in the family. He survived the slaughter by Constantine's sons of Constantine's descendants because he was only 6 years old at the time. So who wants to kill a six-year-old boy? He's no threat. But his father died in the slaughter, meaning his father died because the Christians wanted to protect their throne. So they killed the other Christian brothers and uncles so they could have their throne. Again, and he knew this. Although he hated the Christianity of Constantius, he was forced to receive a Christian education. He had to go to Christian schools. From the bishop of Arian, the Arian bishop Eusebius. So the church historian Eusebius was the one who, Julian was baptized, watch, read this line. Julian was baptized, educated for clerical order, ordained as a lector, and that would be someone who stood up and read the scriptures in the church. You couldn't just, you know, whose turn to read. You had to be ordained to be the one who stood up and read. You weren't necessarily the speaker, you were the reader. And then the bishop or the leader would come out and give his message. So he was a lector, prayed, fasted, celebrated the martyrs, paid reverence to the bishops, and sought the blessings of the hermits. Again, that's what they would do. They go off and find these monks or these hermits, and they'd ask them to pray for them, and they'd leave some trinket or some token of appreciation. And so that's how he was raised. He was raised in a, quote, Christian home, a Christian environment. This forced pseudo-Christianity led the intelligent and vigorous Julian to rebel. And again, we call him Julian the Apostate. I don't like him at all. But the thing was, he was too smart, too intelligent, too reflective to just buy into a forced religion. And so he rebelled against it. Because, again, well, he's rebellious. No, he's too smart. He's not going to just buy into this, you're killing people, making us believe there's more to this. Now, he's going to come out on the wrong side of it. But I don't blame him at all for what, you know, his reaction. I wish he would have, you know, found Christ in his own way and found the truth, but he rebels against it. Julian forced him to rebel and became the heathen antichrist known to history as Emperor Julian the Apostate. He was the last non-Christian emperor. So he is the last. Everyone else is going to be a Christian. From here on in, the list of Roman emperors, they're Christian. Now, that don't mean they're Christ-like. That means they're under fighting under the cross. Just like, you know, popes. You know, not all the popes were what you'd consider pope-like. In 355, at the age of 24, Julian became the emperor. Wow. He's 24 years old and he's the emperor. And was initiated into the Eleusinian mysteries, including Julian with the gods, uniting Julian with the gods for power. In other words, he goes deep into paganism. He entered Greek idolatry by practicing whatever this theurgy, the magical rituals to invoke the gods to action. In other words, he's going into demonism. From his position as emperor, he revived mythology by spiritualizing it and uniting it with a few Christian and Oriental ideas. Julian was very intelligent, but also believed he received direct communication from the gods, Jupiter, Apollo, Hercules, through dreams, vision, oracles, and sacrifice. In other words, the demons were talking to him. His moral character was simple, and he embraced Stoic values. So he was also, in a sense, ascetic in his lifestyle. He wasn't the Nero type, the party animal going off all night. He was more of the Stoic, withdrawn, ascetic type, pursuing truth. Julian forced the churches to return the plunder they had taken from the pagan temples, decreased the public influence Christian bishops held, in other words, removed them from office, removed the bishop's right to travel at public expense, and gave church property to the pagans. In his attempt to stamp out Christianity, now this is interesting. This is something that's worth, I've talked about in the Jerusalem book. It's worth looking into. In his attempt to stamp out Christianity, he had enough intelligence to realize that the temple of the Jews had to be rebuilt. And so he visited the site of the temple in Jerusalem and ordered it to be rebuilt. And the temple and the Jews rallied to his support. The Jews are now returning to Jerusalem and they are rebuilding the temple. And this is interesting because people tell you, well, you know, what if the Jews build a temple? My belief is, and this is just my I don't even say insight, and I mean belief in the sense of my gut feeling. I don't know if it's right or not. Is there's nobody going to build the Jewish temple until God allows it to happen. Because Julian, the emperor, is now paying for it. The Jews are being rallied to build the temple in Jerusalem in 350, 363 A.D. And this is what happens. This is the way it records. He visited the site of the temple in Jerusalem and ordered it to be rebuilt. Earthquakes and reported balls of fire from the foundation caused the work of the temple to stop. This is recorded in several places. For some reason, they could not finish the job. And then he was killed fighting the Persians in 363. These are the same Persians who are on their way to burning and destroying churches. He's over there fighting them, and he gets killed. And so that whole thing was brought to a stop. The family of Constantine at that point was extinct upon Julian's death. Constantine is gone. There's no descendants left of Constantine. Isn't that amazing? The great man Constantine, three sons and all these relatives, and boom, after Constantius and Julian die, there's no one left. His whole family's gone. Now we go down this list very quickly, the different emperors and what took place. You see the years, 363. Emperor Jovian, a Roman general, replaced Julian. He restored the crosses and the church's privileges. So he's Christian. He avoided interfering with the church business but favored Athanasius. And here's, you're going to go back and forth. Athanasius is not dead yet. So Athanasius is coming back from exile. He was put into exile. Now he's brought back. What you're going to be going back and forth, these emperors are going back from Arians to supporting the Nicene Creed or supporting Arius or supporting Athanasius. In 375. And remember, that's about the viewing who Jesus Christ is. Was he created or was he the eternal God? Was he a created being just highly favored by God or was he the eternal God himself? That's a huge thing for the church to be pivoting on every time an emperor changes. Valentinian the First held to the policy of religious freedom, okay? Held to the Nicene Orthodoxy, but stayed out of doctrinal controversies. Again, these are emperors, not bishops. So he says, I support the church, here's what I favor, but hey, you guys are the church, we're the government. Valens' brother ruled the East and favored the Arians and persecuted the supporters of Athanasius. With the death of Valens, Arianism died out in the East. So when his brother Valens died, Arianism died out in the East, and the Greek Orthodox Church is left to the Nicene Creed, which is Athanasius, Jesus is eternal God. And again, the Nicene Council was held in the territory of what is known as the Greek Orthodox Church. So that's the end of Arian in the East. People practicing pagan religions under his time with magical arts, bloody sacrifice, and divination were burnt alive, while those joining the worship were beaten to death with straps loaded with lead. So if you're an actual practicing pagan priest, you'd be burnt. If you're practicing, visiting these pagan rituals, they'd beat you with straps loaded with lead. Sounds like some kind of a shop project without proper teacher supervision. Kids make that kind of stuff if you don't properly supervise your shop class. They come up with these ideas. Paganism died out in the city and was reported to only exist in remote villages by 375. I mean, there's just some place in the remote areas, but in the cities, no one wants to be a pagan. This was followed by Emperor Gratian. Favored Christianity, was the first emperor to reject the Roman emperor's title, Pontifex Maximus. And that's the pagan title, the pagan high priest title of he was the emperor, starting with Caesar, Caesar Augustus, all the way up to Constantine. They all had the title. Basically what it means is they're the chief priest of all the pagan religions, in a very simple way of saying it. He rejects that title, Pontifex Maximus. He removed the altar of victory, which was the one of the foundational pieces of work in the Roman Senate. The golden statue of the goddess Victory was removed. It had been replaced there by Octavian or Augustus Caesar. Now, notice the years 375 to 383. The empire is going to continue to be overrun by barbarians. And if you are a pagan, if you are a true Roman with Roman religion, Roman family, and you have generations of Romans, you understand why you're being overrun by barbarians. It's because of these Christian emperors. I mean, they're mocking the gods of the Romans. They're removing the altar of victory. They're desecrating the ancient gods, and so we're being judged for it. And so what is the problem with the fall of Rome at this time if you're a pagan? The problem is Christianity, an inferior religion, has taken over and offended the gods, and we're being punished. Again, that's the religion, and that is what's happening. Augustine's going to have to rise and write against that kind of logic. Gratian confiscated pagan temple property, abolished the privilege of the temple priest and the virgins, and withdrew the public support of pagan religion. And there's a quote by Philip Schaff. He's got an eight-volume set of church history books, which is really foundational for church history today. He wrote in 1889. I've had a set of this for years. But he says right here about this time, by this step, heathenism became like Christianity before Constantine, and now in the American Republic. Dependent on the voluntary system, while unlike Christianity, it had no spirit of self-sacrifice, no energy of self-preservation. The withdrawal of public support cut its life string and left it still to exist for a time by inertia only. In other words, Schaff is saying there that when they took away the public support of paganism and of heathenism, it just faded away because it had no inertia. Where Christianity, during a time of persecution, during a time of being oppressed, will still continue to rise and flourish because there's life to it, there's truth to it. And many times you can see in church history or in world history that Christianity, although it's oppressed, will eventually conquer its conquerors because of the truth that's being presented. Where heathenism, once it's cut, once the finances of the public support were cut off, it just died out. Where Christianity, you can cut off public support, and it will still find a way to survive because of the truth. That's what Schaff is saying, and he was writing that in 1889. Valentinian II now. Now, this is the, remember we mentioned Ambrose in Milan. Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, responded for the Emperor Valentinian to a senator who had approached the emperor on behalf of the heathen party. Ambrose's response to the heathen senator's request to restore the worship to the pagan gods in order to restore the glory of Rome had 4 points of rejection. So during Valentinian's reign, the new emperor comes in, one of the pagan senators of Rome comes to him and says, here's what we need to do. If we're going to save our empire, we need to restore pagan worship. And Ambrose, who is the Bishop of Milan, who's going to become, he's a great Christian leader. Again, he was the one who was voted in before he was even baptized for the leadership position of Milan, the bishop position of Milan, because he's such a great leader himself. He makes 4 basic points to reject. He responds for Valentinian, the emperor, to this senator who wants to restore pagan worship in Rome. He writes this. He says, granting the heathen request would renunciate Christian convictions. If you're a Christian, you can't build a pagan temple. You can't restore a pagan altar. Number 2, Rome's greatness was not due to idolatry, since many lands conquered by Rome worshipped idols also. It's illogical to think our problem is we abandoned the Roman gods. That's not the reason we're being crushed by the barbarians. Because we crushed people as Romans who worshiped gods like we did, idols. He contrasted Christianity, which was advancing during this time, during its time of persecution, because when Christianity was persecuted, what did it do? It just kept coming. And heathenism, which could not maintain its own numbers without state support. In other words, it goes back to the story of Gideon. Remember, Gideon's father was the priest of Baal in Gideon's city? And Gideon tore down the altar, and the people found out who did it. They brought Gideon and says he's the one who did it. And his dad was supposed to bring judgment on his son. And he says, let Baal judge him. In other words, if Baal's such a great God, let Baal take care of him. And Gideon's name became, remember, Jerubbaal. He's the one that contends with Baal. In other words, Baal's got his number. Watch out, stay away from Gideon because Baal is going to crush him. Just don't mess with him. And Jerubbaal, or Gideon, continued to use that name throughout his lifetime. Who are you? I'm the one Baal's killing. And then Gideon just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And Baal never did show up and do the job. And so Ambrose is giving Valentinian the same advice or using the same argument against the center. If heathenism is so important and it's so powerful, then why do you need to come to the Senate and beg the emperor to finance it? Let it happen. And that's his argument. Meaning Christianity, when we were persecuted, we didn't beg, we didn't need, we need help. We just kept preaching the truth, and now we control the empire. Now it's your turn. If you're so powerful, let it happen. But you can't, you're here begging to be restored to your position. But if you need to beg, you have there's nothing here to worry about. You're powerless. And then he compared Christianity's multitude of consecrated virgins and ascetics with heathenism's lack of benevolent works or mercy for the oppressed. In other words, you look around Christianity, although you look at, for me, I look at the monks and monasteries, it's like, I don't understand that at all. But notice what they did. As they got together, they ended up doing what? They started doing good deeds. When they came together, they didn't end up having some kind of, you know, wicked, you know, sexual practice, orgy-like worship before the gods. They ended up coming together and doing good deeds for the community, trying to help the poor, trying to serve, trying to reach out, became sources, centers of education. Where the heathens, when they come together in their worship, look at the Canaanites. They became culturally corrupt. And so he compared their history. And so those 4 points are very, very good points as far as the difference between Christianity and paganism. And Ambrose, once again, provided that information for Valentinian, who then rejected that senator's request for public support for, in other words, go ahead, knock yourself out, but we're not going to create or support your religion if it's already dead, which is very interesting when you compare Christianity and other things. Okay, Theodosius the Great. Theodosius was one of Rome's best emperors. He supported the Nicene Orthodoxy, that would be Athanasius, deity of Jesus Christ, and at the Council of Constantinople, we'll mention that again later, in 381, he secured for the supporters of Nicene Orthodoxy all the privileges of the state religion. So at that Council of Constantinople, he convinced the state, you support the Nicene Creed, you support Athanasius, you support the deity of Jesus Christ as eternal God, and cut off the Arian support and let them wither away. And they did it. He had rigid laws against Christian heretics, including punishment for visits to heathen temples. If you're a Christian, you visit a heathen temple, you'd be punished. Heathens were allowed to hold public office and allowed free speech. A heathen was appointed as a prefect of Constantinople and educated Theodosius' son. During this time, the fanaticism of the monks and the Christians reached a peak of rage and destruction. So notice these years, 392 to 395. It's worth understanding and noticing this. The persecution against heathen, the Christians had justified in their minds that the heathens were worthy of death. The heathen temples were worthy of being burnt and destroyed. And here's what they did. The Christians believed the pagan gods were demons that occupied the temples. Okay, I would agree with that. Great works of heathen architecture were destroyed by the Christians. In other words, it's heathen, tear it down. Sounds like ISIS. Marcellus, a bishop in Syria, a Christian bishop in Syria, was accompanied by an armed band of soldiers and gladiators that destroyed monuments and centers of heathen worship in his area. So the bishop took an army and gladiators and went around and destroyed anything that was pagan. Just exactly, well, I don't want to say exactly, but very similar to what Islam does when it comes in and it destroys anything that they think is not worshiping Allah, they crush it. Which is devastating, again, to archaeology. Again, I'm all in support of excavating Canaanite sites. There's a great Canaanite altar at Megiddo. It's from the time of Abraham. It's great. It's like, should we blow it up? No, I think we should preserve it. It's like, well, it's pagan. It's like, right, but it's history. Anyway, you understand the argument there. In the point number four here that took place, Hypatia, a beautiful and intelligent lady of Alexandria, that's in northern Africa, and a teacher of Neoplatonic philosophy, who was respected by Christians and heathens, was seized one day in the street by fanatical monks. Now, this is a person who is not a Christian, but they're outstanding intellectually. They're very reasonable. They're respected in the community. But the monks decide she needs to die. And so she was seized in the street by fanatical monks and Christians who drug her out of her carriage, then took her to the cathedral where they tore her apart and burnt her. Cyril, the Bishop of Alexandria, had encouraged this kind of behavior. Again, I don't agree with people that have a wrong philosophy or a different worldview, but I don't know if this is what churches should be out doing. If all of a sudden the church, becomes powerful, we control the Senate, we have Christian president, we have all the military generals around us, do we start destroying anyone who doesn't confess Jesus Christ? Is that I'm afraid that's, in many cases, that's what would happen. If all of a sudden we were not in a position of trying to defend ourselves with truth and logic and trying to hold on and support ourselves, if all of a sudden we had all the power, what would we do? Biblically, I think it's wrong. Biblically, I think we're waiting for Jesus Christ to bring vengeance, and we are to use the sword of the Word, which it goes right back to that very same thing, the sword of logic, the sword of reason, the sword of truth. And our offense is not physical, not flesh and blood, but the truth, and bring people in, win their hearts, and they'll change society. In other words, that's where we leave off right there. John Chrysostom from Antioch writes this: Christians are not to destroy error by force and violence, but should work the salvation of men by persuasion, instruction, and love. Even there, you still have great Christians that are seeing this take place and saying, no, this is not it. This is not what we do. We're here to win a victory, but not a physical victory. We're here to win the hearts. Another one, Augustine writes, let us first obliterate the idols in the hearts of the heathen. And once they become Christian, they will either themselves invite us to execution of so good a work or anticipate us in it. In other words, they themselves will destroy their own idols. Now we must pray for them and not exasperate them. Because what happens when you destroy everything? You get Julian the Apostate is coming. Every time when you destroy a person's religion physically, Julian the Apostate is coming back and is going to hit you. But if you persuade them of the truth, and not everyone's going to be persuaded. It's the age we live in. Okay, we pick up next week. I really wanted to get to, I want to point this out because the next time we come back, Christmas is going to be gone. But if you go over to page 281, there's a picture of the mosaic floor from the Church of the Nativity. The church was to be rebuilt and commissioned in 326 by Constantine. His mother Helena oversaw the construction. This church was dedicated on May 31st, 339. It had an octagonal floor, a plan, it was built above the Church of the Nativity. So there's the Church of the Nativity. This was built above it again. And Jerome Translatin Vulgate there. And that's just some of the mosaics. Some beautiful mosaics are on the floor. And when we were there, remember they had the wooden floor. You could walk on it, but they have the wooden floor would open up with like hinged doors. And you could see the 326 AD mosaic floor, like you're looking at this, and all the design that was put in there by Helena, Constantine's mother, when she was overseeing, because the Church of the Nativity is down in a cave. There's a church built over it, like we talked about, the Persians didn't destroy it. And then over that, Helena built over it. Then over that, the Crusaders built over it. So there's many layers of this church. And that's one of the floors that's in the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, where Jerome went after losing his run for the bishop, went to the monastery there, and then wrote the Latin Vulgate in that place. And that's my Christmas contribution right there, Church of the Nativity. We'll pick that up next week where we're at. Thank you for being here. I'll pray and you're free to go. Father, do thank you again for the chance to look into these things. We ask that we would judge our hearts and we would be a light to our generation as we continue to follow your word and are reformed by your word and brought into the right standing with you and your truth. Again, we thank you for this opportunity and ask again that we would not fail in the mission that you've called us to. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for being here tonight.